Welcome, everybody, to History Analyzed. I'm your host, Mark Palmer. This is a podcast which examines historical events and issues. The issue we're analyzing today is the arsenal of democracy. And by that, I mean the industrial output of the United States, which was the biggest factor in winning World War II. There were a lot of elements that contributed into winning the Second World War. In no particular order, number one, Britain refusing to make peace with Nazi Germany after the fall of France. Even though the UK probably could never have beaten the German war machine by itself, British forces fought the Nazis in Africa and in the skies over Europe. And this meant a constant drain on German military forces and industrial output defending Western Europe and Africa. And for the eventual defeat of Nazi Germany, the island of Great Britain served as an enormous, unsinkable aircraft carrier as a base of operations for the liberation of continental Europe. Number two, the Chinese army. Hundreds of thousands of Japanese soldiers were tied down on the Asian mainland fighting the Chinese, who refused to give up even though they were outmatched by the state-of-the-art Japanese military. It is estimated that the Chinese lost approximately 14 million dead, both military and civilians, in World War II. Number three, the Soviets' willingness to suffer an estimated 27 million deaths. In World War II, the United States suffered approximately 418,000 dead. That is a tremendous number, but the Soviet Union lost about 65 times that amount. 65 times the number of Americans killed in World War II. The majority of the Wehrmacht, the German army, was worn down on the Eastern Front versus the Soviets. The Allied victory in World War II also included incredible sacrifices by people from many other nations like Poland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Norway, as well as France. But World War II was a war between the factories. It was all about industrial production. Whichever side could produce the most military equipment would win. And I'm not diminishing the human sacrifice and the toll that the war took on the military personnel and the civilians alike. However, as I will explain later, the deciding factor in World War II was the ridiculous industrial output of the United States. America supplied the British, Soviets, and Chinese with the necessary tools to defeat the Axis powers. I don't want to make this podcast episode an endless list of statistics, so I'm just going to give you some highlight numbers that I think illustrate the key points. And now, a short disclaimer regarding statistics. I always try to get my statistics from dependable sources, books that I've read, or reliable sources on the internet. If possible, I try to find two sources for key facts. But in researching this episode, I found some discrepancies regarding some of these statistics, but they are all fairly close. These numbers are just to demonstrate the points I'm making. Where did I get that term, the arsenal of democracy? It came from a speech on December 29, 1940, from President Franklin Roosevelt. It was one of his fireside chats, meaning a speech he gave over the radio to the American public. This was a year before the attack on Pearl Harbor. This was after France had fallen and the British Empire was standing alone against Hitler. FDR was explaining to the American public why it was essential to the United States and in America's own self-interest to supply the UK with the necessary military equipment to prevent a Nazi victory.
The Nazi masters of Germany have made it clear that they intend not only to dominate all life and thought in their own country, but also to enslave the whole of Europe, and then to use the resources of Europe to dominate the rest of the world. We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
Today, we are used to the United States having the most sophisticated military and equipment in the world. But in the years before World War II, it was completely opposite. In 1939, when Germany invaded Poland and started World War II, the U.S. military was a joke compared to the other world powers. The U.S. Army ranked about 18th in the world by size. In 1940, President Roosevelt asked American industry to build 50,000 airplanes. FDR also asked for a military budget of $1.2 billion. That would be approximately $26 billion in today's money. The United States began a production of war materials that had never been seen in history. The entire country mobilized. Between 1940 and 1945, 17 million Americans left their homes for a job in a war factory. You know that biblical term of beating plowshares into swords? Well, this was it. There were two primary ways to create war production: the proverbial carrot or the stick. One way was the way that the totalitarian countries did it, where the government directed all aspects of the armaments manufacturing. And if production was not up to the quotas or specifications, there would be severe penalties. It may have been individual companies in Germany and Japan manufacturing the military items, but it was with strict oversight by the government. That was the proverbial stick. The other way was to have private companies manufacture the goods with profit in mind. This was using the carrot instead of the stick. Franklin Roosevelt understood that the best way to proceed was to have American companies produce all of the materials and equipment that would be necessary for World War II. FDR and the War Production Board used true capitalism. They gave these businessmen, and I'm saying men because it was all men in those days, economic reasons to build all of the necessary items for the war. Don't try to appeal to patriotism. Give these companies financial reasons to build more ships, planes, tanks, guns, everything. It's always important to understand what you don't know. FDR realized that he needed somebody who understood how businesses operated. So he asked Bill Knudsen, the president of General Motors, to oversee the start of war production. Bill Knudsen gave up his General Motors salary of $300,000 per year. To put that into perspective, that would be about $6.6 million in today's money. And what was Knudsen's salary for his new position with the government? $1 per year. You heard me correctly. He gave up $300,000 per year with General Motors to go work for the government for $1 per year. Why did he do it? Bill Knudsen could see what was going on in the world. He knew that his country and all of Western civilization needed him. I know that sounds dramatic, but it's true. The U.S. did not have much of a defense industry before World War II, but there was a lot of civilian industry. And no city in the world was more of an industrial powerhouse than Detroit, Michigan. Detroit was the home to the U.S. auto industry, and Detroit was dominant worldwide. In the 1920s, the United States was producing well over 90% of all of the world's cars. Of course, during the 1930s and the Great Depression, sales plummeted for automobiles throughout the world. The auto industry made the city of Detroit. In 1900, Detroit was only the 13th largest city in the U.S. But in 1903, the Ford Motor Company was founded in the Detroit suburb of Dearborn. Other car companies were also beginning around that time in Detroit, such as Chrysler and General Motors. In the 1910 census, Detroit broke into the top 10 largest American cities at number 9. 10 years later, Detroit had climbed to the fourth largest city in the country, behind only New York, Chicago, and Philadelphia. Until the decline of the U.S. auto industry beginning in the 1970s, Detroit was either the fourth or fifth largest city in America. Unfortunately, since then, Detroit has been in a severe decline. It is incredibly depressing to see what has happened to Detroit. The Motor City has lost almost 66% of its peak population from 1950. That is almost two-thirds of the population gone. But in this episode, we're going to be talking about Detroit at its most vibrant. Detroit did more to defeat the Axis powers than any other city in the world because a large percentage of the military equipment that I'm talking about in this episode was built in Detroit. The key to Detroit's success was mass production utilizing the assembly line. Henry Ford did not invent the automobile, but he was the mechanical genius who perfected the assembly line for automobiles. Instead of having master craftsmen, Ford had his cars produced by many workers, each doing one simple task over and over and over. As the car passed down the assembly line, that particular worker simply performed the same job on that car and the next car and the next. Just because somebody has a skill that benefits all of mankind, it does not mean that he or she is a good person. Unfortunately, that was the case with Henry Ford. He was a huge anti-Semite, so much so that he bought a newspaper to publish his rants against the Jews. In 1919, Henry Ford purchased a newspaper called the Dearborn Independent. Between 1920 and 1922, the front page of the Dearborn Independent contained many anti-Semitic editorials and articles. Adolf Hitler was a great fan of Henry Ford. Hitler's office in the 1920s contained a picture of Henry Ford. Hitler also had copies of a four-volume book entitled The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. That four-volume series of books was an anthology of articles published by the Dearborn Independent newspaper claiming to expose Jews' supposed financial and commercial control, usurpation of political power, monopoly of necessities, and autocratic direction of the very news that the American people read. Hitler admired Ford for two reasons. Number one, of course, Hitler liked all of that anti-Semitic insanity. Number two, Hitler wanted to emulate Ford's success with the Model T, which became an automobile for the masses. That's why in the 1930s, Hitler ordered the development of a German people's car, the Volkswagen. If you ever wondered what that name Volkswagen means, that's it, people's car. In July 1938, German diplomats awarded Henry Ford the Grand Cross of the German Eagle. That was considered the highest honor from Nazi Germany to any foreigner. Although this was before the Nazis implemented the full-scale campaign of murder known as the Holocaust, by the summer of 1938, the despicable actions of Hitler's government towards Jews, as well as other persons considered undesirable, were already known throughout the U.S. Henry Ford should never have accepted that medal. It was a disgrace. And Henry Ford was not the only American to accept a medal from the Nazis. In October 1938, Charles Lindbergh, the man who became famous in 1927 for flying solo across the Atlantic, accepted the Service Cross of the German Eagle from Hermann Göring. In case you're not familiar with Hermann Göring, he was the number two man in Nazi Germany behind Adolf Hitler. So the next time you read or see anything about Charles Lindbergh being a hero, remember that fact. One other thing about Adolf Hitler, he never learned how to drive a car. That's why you always see him in the front passenger seat. He had to be driven because he could not drive himself. Okay, getting back to Henry Ford. Fortunately, his son Edsel did a lot to redeem the Ford family name during World War II, as I'll explain in a little bit. And in case you have ever heard of the disastrous automobile line in the 1950s called the Edsel, yes, that's where the name came from, Henry Ford's only son. Possibly the best example of the incredible industrial might of the United States was aircraft carriers. For centuries, navies kept building bigger and bigger ships with bigger and bigger guns. This concept reached the pinnacle in the battleships of the 20th century. But World War I was the sunset of battleships. Shortly after the Great War, it was proven that battleships were no match for airplanes. It was an American who first proved this concept. General William Billy Mitchell is regarded as the father of the United States Air Force. He was an early proponent of air power. He famously said that nothing can stop the attack of aircraft except other aircraft. Billy Mitchell believed that the age of battleships was over and that aircraft could sink even the most formidable battleships. In July 1921, he proved it, using a captured German battleship called the Ostfriedland. Mitchell and his 1st Provisional Air Brigade sank the battleship using only aircraft. And you have to remember how primitive airplanes were in 1921. Amazingly, the United States military, and apparently the rest of the world, failed to understand what Billy Mitchell had proved. Most countries still thought that the battleships reigned supreme. It was the British who proved Mitchell's theory in actual combat. In November 1940, France had already surrendered to the Nazis. Britain was barely holding on along with its empire and the British Commonwealth nations. Today, we look back at the Italian military in World War II as a joke, but Benito Mussolini had built a formidable navy in the Mediterranean. The Italians had a large naval base in the city of Taranto in the southeast portion of the Italian peninsula. On the night of November 11 and 12, 1940, the British launched 21 Swordfish bombers from an aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean. These were obsolete biplanes like you saw in World War I. They launched torpedoes and dropped bombs. 3 Italian battleships had been damaged so much that they were inoperable, along with several other ships sunk or badly damaged. For some reason, this incredible raid by the Royal Navy is largely overlooked. I don't know why, but this is where Japanese Admiral Yamamoto got the idea for the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now let's look at some numbers. In December 1941, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the Imperial Japanese Navy had a total of 9 aircraft carriers. You will see some conflicting numbers because of arguments as to what qualified as an actual aircraft carrier and what was in commission at a particular time. Not all were fleet carriers. That term fleet carrier means the biggest and fastest of the aircraft carriers. In December 1941, the American Navy had 7 aircraft carriers. 4 of them were assigned to the Atlantic. Those were the Yorktown, Ranger, Wasp, and the brand new Hornet. The other 3 carriers were assigned to the Pacific Fleet. Those were the Enterprise, Lexington, and Saratoga. None of the American carriers were at Pearl Harbor on the Day of Infamy. Throughout all of World War II, only 5 American fleet carriers were sunk: the Yorktown, the Lexington, the Hornet, the Wasp, and the Princeton. For the attack on Pearl Harbor, Japanese Admiral Yamamoto assigned his 6 best fleet carriers. Of the 6 Japanese aircraft carriers that launched the raid on Pearl Harbor, 4 were sunk by planes from American aircraft carriers during the Battle of Midway on June 4, 1942. They were the Akagi, Kaga, Soryu, and Hiryu. That means that 4 of the 6 aircraft carriers that attacked Pearl Harbor were sunk within 6 months of the Pearl Harbor raid. The other 2 Japanese aircraft carriers were not at Midway. The Shukaku was sunk by torpedoes from an American submarine during the Battle of the Philippine Sea on June 19, 1944. The last of the 6 Japanese aircraft carriers from the Pearl Harbor attack was the Zuikaku. It was sunk by American aircraft on October 25, 1944, at the Battle off Cape Engano in the Philippines. And now I will get to the point. The Americans could afford to lose their most valuable ships, but the Japanese could not. In World War II, the Imperial Japanese Navy had a total of 18 aircraft carriers. 14 of those were sunk during the war by American forces. Conversely, the United States started cranking out naval ships in incredible rates. By the time Japan surrendered in August 1945, the United States had 99 aircraft carriers, 71 of those were the smaller escort-type carriers, which I'll explain later. But there were also 28 fleet carriers, which were the large aircraft carriers like the famous USS Enterprise. I'm not going to go through all of the naval ships produced by the United States. Again, I don't want this episode to simply be a long list of facts and figures. Just as important as the naval ships were merchant ships. American factories were producing more equipment and supplies for warfare and the necessities of sustaining life than any time in the history of the world. But the U.S. needed to get all of this equipment and supplies to its allies and American armed forces throughout the world. This brings us to the crucial type of merchant boat known as the Liberty Ships. Two-thirds of all cargo that left the United States during World War II was carried on Liberty Ships. This included military equipment as well as food and other necessities for life. German U-boats were strangling the UK. In 1941 alone, the Germans sank over 1,000 British ships. The answer to the U-boat problem was an American manufacturer named Henry Kaiser. He wasn't even a shipbuilder, but he did understand construction and manufacturing. Kaiser was one of the main people who built the Hoover Dam on the Colorado River. Kaiser met with the British, who already had a simple merchant ship design. It was based upon a British ship called the Liberty. That's where this name Liberty Ships comes from. Liberty ships were extremely basic. No frills. Kaiser got the contract from the U.S. government. But before he could build ships, Henry Kaiser had to build shipyards. He built his first shipyard in Richmond, California, which is located on the San Francisco Bay. There was essentially nothing there. Kaiser and his company had to build all of the infrastructure for the shipyard. Contrary to all of the expert predictions, Kaiser built his Richmond shipyard in only 3 months. It opened in April 1941. You'll note that this was 8 months before Pearl Harbor. Within 3 years, the town of Richmond's population grew over 600%. To keep his shipyard producing, Kaiser had to build homes and all of the infrastructure for all of those new houses built in Richmond. This was a new type of shipyard. It was designed from the start to mass produce boats. Kaiser based his shipyards based upon the automobile plants in Detroit. Prior to Henry Kaiser, ships were built one at a time. These Liberty ships would be made on a production line. Somebody in the Kaiser company discovered that welding was faster and more efficient than using rivets. Instead of building one ship at a time, the Liberty ships were produced in sections, and then those sections were welded together to form a complete ship. To give you an idea how much cargo each Liberty ship could transport, a Liberty ship could hold almost 3,000 Jeeps. This is how planes, tanks, and everything else produced in the United States was transported to Britain, the Soviet Union, and American armed forces around the globe. Eventually, Kaiser had 7 shipyards in the U.S. After Pearl Harbor, there was a scramble for quality workers in the shipyards as well as the other factories that were producing planes, tanks, and everything else. As an incentive to attract workers to his shipyards, Henry Kaiser offered a healthcare program that covered the employees as well as their families. The healthcare program only cost the workers 80 cents per week. 91% of Kaiser employees subscribed to the healthcare program. This healthcare program still exists in certain parts of the United States. It's very big here in California. It's known as Kaiser Permanente. The explosion of people working in U.S. shipyards was amazing. In 1933, there were only approximately 50,000 shipyard employees in the U.S. 10 years later, by 1943, in the middle of World War II, there were 1.7 million people working in shipyards throughout America. As a result of this incredible production of merchant ships, along with the naval escort ships like destroyers, the Nazi U-boats could not bring the UK to its knees. In all of history, there's only been one truly successful submarine campaign, and that was the U.S. against Japan. Like Britain, Japan is an island nation which needs to import most of its essentials. The U.S. submarine campaign strangled Japan. Five different contractors were producing American Gato-class submarines at the rate of one new submarine every 8 days by the summer of 1942. This was the first mass-produced submarine. The U.S. subfleet constituted less than 2% of the U.S. Navy vessels, but the submarines accounted for approximately 30% of all Japanese ships sunk during World War II. During World War II, the United States lost 52 submarines, but they sank over 1,100 Japanese ships. That total included over half of Japan's merchant fleet. Conversely, at the end of World War II, the United States had approximately 6,000 merchant ships in use. The mass production of U.S. submarines, combined with the mass production of Liberty ships, meant that American industry could cripple Japan's economy and ability to fight the war and feed itself, while at the same time, the U.S. could keep Britain, China, and the Soviet Union properly supplied and in the war. Earlier, I told you about the incredible production of aircraft carriers and how that was the key factor in the Pacific War. Henry Kaiser was a main player in this area as well. In World War II, the U.S. Navy had essentially two types of aircraft carriers. There were the fleet carriers, which were massive ships approximately 900 feet or about 275 meters long. Then there were the much smaller escort carriers. They would only carry about 20 to 27 airplanes as compared to the 60 to 90 planes on a fleet carrier. The escort carriers were also slower, traveling approximately 18 knots compared to the approximately 33 knots of a fleet carrier. But the escort carriers were cheaper and much faster to build. Henry Kaiser built these escort carriers like he built Liberty ships. In 2 years, Kaiser built 50 escort carriers. The U.S. built a total of 122 escort carriers in World War II. Throughout the entire war, Japan built only a total of 7 to 10 escort aircraft carriers. I found conflicting reports on the numbers. Tanks were invented toward the end of World War I and did not play a major role in the Great War. But land battles in World War II were dominated by tanks and self-propelled guns. Although the Germans had been gearing up for war long before the United States, America produced over twice as many of these crucial vehicles as Nazi Germany. From 1938 until 1945, the Germans produced over 46,000. America produced approximately 95,500 tanks and self-propelled guns. Probably more important than tanks in World War II land warfare were trucks and jeeps. When we think of the Wehrmacht, the German army, we usually think of this very modern and mechanized war machine. But the Wehrmacht relied a lot on horses. Horses pulled 2/3 of the vehicles and moved 80% of the German army's equipment and supplies. When Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941 in Operation Barbarossa, that was the largest invasion in the history of the world. The Germans and their allies had over 3 million men. When you see photos and videos from that offensive into the Soviet Union, you always see tanks. It makes the whole operation appear mechanized. But in Operation Barbarossa, the Germans used approximately 750,000 horses and mules. The Germans did not film the 750,000 horses and mules pulling their equipment and supplies. Motor vehicles were much more efficient and durable. Horses and mules died from wounds, exhaustion, exposure to the elements, and starvation. But the Germans could not produce enough motor vehicles to move and supply their army. On the other hand, the American auto plants, mostly in Detroit, could produce massive amounts of motor vehicles. Possibly the most ubiquitous mechanized vehicle of World War II was the American Jeep. If you're not familiar with that term, it was an all-terrain vehicle capable of transporting men and material. If you have seen any World War II movies, you have seen Americans riding around in these relatively small four-wheel drive vehicles that could hold four men and seemingly could go anywhere. There's a big dispute about the origin of the name, but it seems the most plausible explanation was the fact that it was called a general purpose vehicle and went by the initials GP for general purpose, which somehow became Jeep. Others claim that the name came from a character in the Popeye comics called Eugene the Jeep. Who knows? But during the war, the United States manufactured almost 650,000 Jeeps. But more impressive than the Jeep production was the number of military trucks manufactured in the United States. American industry delivered over 2.4 million military trucks during World War II. Germany produced less than 350,000 military trucks. This is why the Germans were so reliant on horses and mules, while the Allies could use much more efficient and reliable army trucks. Now let's talk about aircraft. The United States Air Force would need incredible numbers of planes. By the way, there was no separate U.S. Air Force at the time. During World War II, it was called the United States Army Air Forces. The separate U.S. Air Force was not created until July 1947. It would be boring to give you all of the production numbers throughout World War II. So let's just focus on the most critical year of the war, 1944. This was when all of the combatant countries were operating at maximum capacity. The following figures combine all types of aircraft: heavy bombers, medium bombers, light bombers, fighters, scout planes, seaplanes, and planes to be used on aircraft carriers. In 1944, Japan produced approximately 21,000 of all types of aircraft. In that same year, Germany built over 34,000 airplanes. What about America's allies? In 1944, the UK produced over 22,000 aircraft. The Soviet Union constructed over 33,000 planes. How about the arsenal of democracy? In 1944 alone, the United States manufactured 74,000 planes of all types. That is an incredible statistic. In 1944, America was producing around 34% more than the combined efforts of the UK and the Soviet Union. And the US was also outproducing the combined aircraft output of Germany and Japan by approximately 34%. The best example of why the U.S. could produce airplanes in such ridiculous numbers was because of the largest factory in the world, known as Willow Run. During World War II, there were a lot of people in the military who thought that the most important strategic asset was the heavy bomber. Planes that delivered bombs came in various sizes. The heavy bombers were the ones that could carry the largest payloads and could travel the farthest distances. The most famous one that you've probably heard of was the B-17, known as the Flying Fortress. It's that big bomber with four engines. And towards the end of the war, the US developed the B-29 Super Fortress. The B-29 could fly higher and farther and carry bigger payloads than any plane that had ever been built. These were the planes that dropped the atomic bombs on Japan. They were so complicated that the B-29 project cost more than the Manhattan Project, which developed the atomic bombs. It's another example of the incredible industrial output of the U.S. during World War II. But I want to tell you about the lesser-known heavy bomber, which was essentially a counterpart to the B-17, and that was the B-24, which was known as the Liberator. The B-17 was designed and built before the war and was first placed into service in the mid-1930s. Consolidated Aircraft in San Diego told the Army Air Corps that it could build a heavy bomber that was better than the B-17. So Consolidated Aircraft designed the B-24 Liberator. The prototype was tested in 1939. The B-24 could carry more payload, meaning more bombs, and could fly farther, faster, and higher than the B-17. More B-24s were built than any other American airplane in World War II. And that was mostly because of Edsel Ford. Although Consolidated Aircraft had developed the B-24, they could not produce them fast enough. This is where Edsel Ford stepped in. Earlier I told you about Henry Ford's despicable anti-Semitism. Well, his son Edsel saved the reputation of the Ford family and the Ford Motor Company. Edsel Ford told the U.S. government that he could mass produce B-24 Liberators the same way his company had mass produced automobiles. Just about everybody in the aviation industry thought he was crazy. You have to remember that after World War I, the United States was very isolationist. This meant that there was very little production of war materials. But now, the threat of Nazi Germany and imperialist Japan had become real. The federal government really wanted a mass-produced heavy bomber. Edsel Ford built an entirely new factory in Ypsilanti, Michigan. It was along a stream named Willow Run. That term, run, for a creek or stream is not very common. But for anybody who's read about the American Civil War, the first major battle was along a creek called Bull Run in Virginia. Anyway, that stream gave the factory its name, and it became famous as Willow Run. It was built in 1941. This factory was enormous. It covered 4.2 million square feet, or 390,000 square meters. To put that into perspective, the Empire State Building in Midtown Manhattan, which was made famous when King Kong climbed to the top in the movies, contains approximately 2.8 million square feet, or 260,000 square meters of office space. That meant that Willow Run had approximately 50% more space than the Empire State Building. Edsel Ford, spurred on by Ford production chief Charles Sorensen, made the preposterous claim that he could build a factory which would produce a B-24 bomber every hour. The first Liberators were completed at Willow Run in December 1942. By the summer of 1944, they had achieved that goal of producing a heavy bomber every hour. This was insane. It's one thing to mass produce automobiles, but to spit out a huge heavy bomber every hour was just remarkable. Cars at that time had approximately 15,000 parts and weighed somewhere around 3,000 pounds or around 1,360 kilograms. The B-24 had 450,000 parts and weighed approximately 18 tons. This is why the aircraft industry thought that Edsel Ford was crazy. This could not be done. But the Ford Motor Company pulled it off. At Willow Run, Ford produced a total of 8,645 B-24 Liberators. That one factory outside of Detroit almost equaled the four factories operated by aircraft companies Consolidated Aircraft, Douglas Aircraft, and North American Aviation, who were also producing B-24 Liberators. In those four factories, they produced a total of 9,808 B-24s. By the end of 1944, the U.S. Army Air Forces decided that they had too many B-24s and greatly scaled back the orders for more Liberators. In May 1945, Nazi Germany surrendered. There was not much further use for B-24s or B-17s. In the Pacific, the newer, faster, and bigger, and much more sophisticated B-29s were used for the long-range bombing campaign against Japan. The Willow Run plant closed in June 1945. The Willow Run plant was later reopened to manufacture automobiles. But the B-24 still holds the record of the most produced American combat aircraft with a total of over 18,400 Liberators. Of course, American manufacturers were also producing many other bombers during World War II. Almost 13,000 B-17s were built during the war. The ultimate weapon in World War II was the atomic bomb. Whatever your feelings are about the atomic bomb, it was easily the most amazing industrial achievement of the first half of the 20th century. The Manhattan Project was as much a triumph of engineering and industry as of science. Only the United States had the industrial base to achieve a working atomic bomb by 1945. Approximately 130,000 people were employed by the Manhattan Project at its peak. There were labs and industrial sites all over the U.S. producing all the essential materials, including, but not limited to, uranium and plutonium. The Manhattan Project proceeded with two types of atomic bombs, one based upon uranium, particularly the isotope uranium-235, and the other based upon plutonium, particularly the isotope plutonium-239. Why did the Manhattan Project develop both uranium and plutonium bombs? Scientists in the Manhattan Project understood that uranium-235 was the most likely source of a nuclear detonation. The problem was accumulating enough of that isotope. Only about 7% of natural uranium is the isotope uranium-235. The most common uranium isotope is uranium-238, but it was not considered suitable for a nuclear weapon. In 1942, the head of the Manhattan Project, General Leslie Groves, selected a sparsely populated area of Oak Ridge, Tennessee, to build a massive facility to enrich uranium to create the isotope uranium-235. By the end of World War II, over 80,000 people were working at the Oak Ridge facility. What about plutonium as a basis for an atomic bomb? Although uranium was discovered in the late 1700s, plutonium was a new element. Plutonium was only discovered in December 1940 at the University of California at Berkeley. Fun fact, it was named plutonium after the ninth planet Pluto, since the last two previously discovered elements, uranium and neptunium, were named after the seventh and eighth planets in our solar system, Uranus and Neptune. And before anybody has a fit, I'm aware that in 2006, the International Astronomical Union issued a ruling that Pluto was no longer considered a planet and is now one of several dwarf planets in our solar system. But in 1940, Pluto was still designated as a planet. Anyway, back to plutonium. Plutonium is considered a man-made element. It's true that scientists have found trace elements of naturally occurring plutonium, but only under very rare geologic situations. Thus, as one of the first steps in the Manhattan Project, enough plutonium, and specifically the isotope plutonium-239, had to be created. Plutonium has an atomic number of 94, and uranium has an atomic number of 92. Atomic numbers are the numbers of protons in the nucleus of an atom. To create plutonium, scientists used a reactor to add two protons to uranium. Even though I've read books on this subject, I really don't understand how this is done. The part I do grasp is that scientists can take the type of uranium, which is not the proper isotope for a nuclear reaction, and convert it into plutonium, which can be used for a nuclear reaction. Starting in late 1942, the United States built a brand new plutonium production complex in Hanford, Washington. There were other facilities scattered around the U.S. for the Manhattan Project, but the big three were Oak Ridge to produce uranium-235, Hanford to produce plutonium-239, and the actual facility for the scientists to design an atom bomb. The genius physicist who is considered the father of the atomic bomb, J. Robert Oppenheimer, owned a ranch in New Mexico and suggested New Mexico for a place to build a laboratory complex. In the fall of 1942, a large plot of land at Los Alamos, northwest of Santa Fe, was purchased to build the facility. The U.S. government built an entire town at Los Alamos. Obviously, they built facilities for the scientists to conduct their work. But since America is a free country and the scientists had to volunteer, the federal government had to make this military post as comfortable as possible for these scientists and their families. This meant that they had to build housing. In 1945, it was estimated that 8,200 people were residing at Los Alamos. This required electricity, plumbing, food services, and all of the other necessities for life. There was a school with grades 1 through 12. The point of all this is that the American government could build such a facility simply to provide a place for the scientists to develop atomic weapons. No other country had the resources in the midst of the largest war in history to build such a facility, along with the giant facilities at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and Hanford, Washington, to develop enough of the suitable isotopes of uranium and plutonium. And of course, this is not even considering the expense and engineering marvels that were necessary to actually develop the atomic bombs. And the United States was doing this while also greatly outdistancing any other country in the production of planes, ships, tanks, and everything else necessary to win World War II. I'm not saying the development and use of atomic weapons were not controversial. I'm just pointing out that the industrial achievement by the U.S. in producing these weapons was remarkable. If you're interested, I did a 2-episode series on the making and use of the atomic bomb in World War II. The incredible production of all of these military items was one thing, but getting them to America's allies was another. Shortly after FDR died in April 1945, Winston Churchill was addressing the British House of Commons. Among the praises he gave to his friend, Churchill said that Roosevelt devised the extraordinary measure of assistance called Lend-Lease, which will stand forth as the most unselfish and unsordid financial act of any country in all history. So what was Lend-Lease? It was a program passed on March 11, 1941, that permitted the United States to lend or lease war supplies to any nation deemed vital to the defense of the United States. FDR had already been helping Britain. In the summer of 1940, the UK was desperate for destroyers, ships to fend off the German U-boats. Roosevelt traded 50 American destroyers for 99-year leases on British bases in the Caribbean and Newfoundland. But Britain needed a lot more equipment and supplies, and the UK could not afford to pay for it. So Roosevelt came up with the concept of Lend-Lease. FDR explained his idea at a press conference on December 17, 1940. This was a year before Pearl Harbor and 6 months before Operation Barbarossa, when the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union, meaning this was a time when it was only the UK, along with its empire, standing up to Hitler. In that press conference, Roosevelt said, "In the present world situation, of course, there is absolutely no doubt in the mind of a very overwhelming number of Americans that the best immediate defense of the United States is the success of Great Britain in defending itself, and that, therefore, quite aside from our historic and current interest in the survival of democracy in the world as a whole, it is equally important from a selfish point of view of American defense that we should do everything to help the British Empire to defend itself." Later in the press conference, Roosevelt explained, "I go back to the idea that the one thing necessary for American national defense is additional productive facilities. And the more we increase those facilities, factories, shipbuilding ways, munition plants, etc., and so on, the stronger American national defense is. Orders from Great Britain are therefore a tremendous asset to American national defense because they automatically create additional facilities. I am talking selfishly here, from the American point of view, nothing else. Therefore, from the selfish point of view, that production must be encouraged by us." You can see what FDR was trying to do in this press conference. This was a year before Pearl Harbor. Most Americans were still very isolationist. They did not want to get involved in World War II. A lot of people did not want to help Britain because they thought it would lead to war with Germany. Roosevelt was trying to convince Americans that assisting Britain at that time was in America's own selfish interest. Roosevelt then explained that there were different ways for the United States to produce these necessary goods when Britain could not afford to pay for American products at that time. One way was to loan money to the UK so that the British government could then spend that money to buy American goods. A second way was to simply gift the military supplies, equipment, and food to the UK. Roosevelt then recommended a third alternative. America would produce all of the necessary supplies and equipment and then either lend or lease these items to the British. The U.S. wasn't just giving these items to the U.K. We were only lending or leasing them. Then Roosevelt gave his famous homespun example. He said, suppose your neighbor's house is on fire and you have a large garden hose. If the neighbor asks to borrow the hose, you don't haggle over the price of the hose. You loan it to the neighbor because it's an emergency. Then, when the fire is over, the neighbor returns it to you. If the garden hose is still in good shape, you haven't lost anything. If the garden hose is somehow damaged and can no longer be used, the neighbor will either replace it or compensate you in some other manner. To sum it all up, FDR was proposing that the U.S. simply loan food and war materials to the British in their time of need, and that the United States would be repaid by the British in some manner when they could afford to do so. This was later extended to the Soviet Union and China. Of course, it was only a wonderful fiction. Roosevelt and everybody in the American military and government understood that the U.S. was probably not going to receive any of these materials or supplies back and would not be paid for the materials that were not returned. But it was a way to get these essential materials to the British and later the Soviets and the Chinese at the critical time. This was probably Franklin Roosevelt's greatest contribution to Allied victory in World War II. He was able to convince a very isolationist country that America had to start producing all of the implements of war immediately, and that the U.S. had to lend or lease these items, and I'm putting that term in quotes, to the British and later the Soviets and the Chinese. FDR's ability to convince the U.S. that this was in America's own selfish interest and was the best thing for America's defense was the most significant thing that Roosevelt did in the war. Because without the Lend-Lease program, as I'll explain in a little bit, the Allies would not have won World War II. At the beginning of this episode, I told you that the biggest contributing factors to the Allied victory in World War II included the refusal of the British to surrender when they were standing alone against the Nazis, and the Chinese and Soviets suffering tremendous losses. There were also contributions of all of the other Allied nations, including Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Poland, and France. But now it's time to explain why the most critical factor in the Allied victory was the industrial output of the United States. World War II was an industrial war. Courage and a willingness to sacrifice are not enough to win in modern mechanical warfare. The people of Britain refused Hitler's overtures for a negotiated peace after the fall of France. Fortunately for the world, the British kept on fighting, but they could not have done so without all of the necessary supplies from the United States. Joseph Stalin was willing to sacrifice approximately 27 million of his own people. That is only an estimate and includes both military and civilian deaths. The best estimates that I could find are that approximately 19 to 20 million of those deaths were civilians, and that means approximately 7 to 8 million of those casualties were military deaths. The point of all these numbers is that the willingness to just sacrifice more and more cannon fodder was not enough. No matter how many deaths the Soviets were willing to endure, it would have been meaningless without the necessary tools to wage modern warfare. Bravery and the willingness to endure tremendous losses are not enough. An easy example was the Poles. When the Nazis invaded Poland, the Polish military fought tenaciously. But they did not have state-of-the-art tanks, planes, and all of the other necessary equipment and supplies to stand up to Hitler's modern war machine. The same applied to the Chinese. When full-scale war broke out between Japan and China in 1937, China had a population of approximately 412 million people. Japan's population was approximately 72 million people. The Chinese were willing to sustain tremendous casualties of approximately 14 million dead. But the Japanese controlled all of China's main cities and coastal regions because they had much superior military equipment. Now let's take a look at how the U.S. kept Britain, the Soviet Union, and China in World War II. Let's start with the British. As an island nation, the UK needed to import a large percentage of its supplies to keep the civilian population alive, as well as to equip the war effort. Prime Minister Winston Churchill understood this more than anybody. According to Churchill, the night he heard about Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor, he went to bed and slept the sleep of the saved. Churchill knew that the ferocious Nazi war machine would not be able to invade Great Britain, but Hitler's U-boats might starve out the British. Churchill understood that after the Pearl Harbor attack, that American industry would gear up and produce more of the necessary items for war than had ever been seen in the history of the world. One of the primary necessities produced by American industry were the Liberty ships I described earlier. Those merchant ships kept the island of Great Britain fully supplied. Of course, the British did not want to simply stay alive. They wanted to defeat Nazi Germany. That was going to require two primary weapons. Number one, sufficient aircraft, both bombers and fighters, to gain air superiority over mainland Europe. Earlier, I outlined the incredible production of aircraft in the U.S. during World War II. Number two, landing craft to transport an invading army from Great Britain to the continent. On D-Day, June 6, 1944, the Allies had 4,126 landing ships and landing craft. Landing craft is completely overlooked when people study World War II. But along with a failure to gain control of the skies, it's one of the main reasons why Hitler could not invade Great Britain in the summer and fall of 1940. And besides D-Day, landing craft played a critical role in the Allied invasions of North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. By the way, my father was involved in all three of those invasions. And as I record this episode, I'm wearing his dog tag from World War II. And of course, landing craft was critical throughout all of the Pacific War versus the Japanese as the American military invaded one island after another. During World War II, the U.S. produced approximately 82,000 of all types of landing crafts. Let's get back to the British. Through Lend-Lease, the British received over $14 billion worth of supplies. That would be approximately $240 billion in today's money. That included aircraft, weapons and ammunition, tanks and other motor vehicles, ships, production machinery, food, and industrial commodities. And those totals do not even count the almost $2 billion worth of Lend-Lease aid from the U.S. to Australia, which was part of the British Commonwealth, but an independent country during World War II. The refusal of China to surrender to the Japanese and the willingness to sustain such incredible losses was an important element in the defeat of Japan. But again, grit and fortitude only go so far in a modern mechanized war. What kept the Chinese going was receiving over $1.7 billion worth of aircraft, weapons, ammunition, tanks and other vehicles, as well as food from the United States through Lend-Lease. That's what kept the Chinese in the war. What supplies did the U.S. give to the USSR during World War II? By the end of the war, America sent its Soviet allies, the following military equipment: 400,000 jeeps and trucks, 14,000 airplanes, 8,000 tractors, 13,000 tanks. In addition, the U.S. sent the Soviets the following supplies: more than 1.5 million blankets, 15 million pairs of army boots, 107,000 tons of cotton, 2.7 million tons of petroleum products to fuel airplanes, trucks, and tanks, and 4.5 million tons of food. The U.S. even transported an entire Ford Company tire factory to the USSR, which made tires for military vehicles. Although I could not find the amounts, America also sent guns, ammunition, explosives, copper, steel, aluminum, medicine, field radios, radar tools, books, and countless other items. From 1941 through 1945, the U.S. sent $11.3 billion in goods to the Soviet Union. That would be worth approximately $188 billion in today's money. America also bankrolled the Allies in World War II. The U.S. was supplying these war materials for free. You don't have to take my opinion as a biased American. In the month before Pearl Harbor, November 1941, Joseph Stalin sent a letter to Franklin Roosevelt that said, "Your decision, Mr. President, to give the Soviet Union an interest-free credit of $1 billion in the form of material supplies and raw materials has been accepted by the Soviet government with heartfelt gratitude as urgent aid to the Soviet Union in its enormous and difficult fight against the common enemy, bloodthirsty Hitlerism." And later, during the Tehran Conference from November 28 to December 1, 1943, between FDR, Stalin, and Churchill, Stalin said in a toast, "The United States is a country of machines. Without the use of those machines through Lend-Lease, we would lose this war." Nikita Khrushchev was the Soviet leader from 1953 until 1964. In his memoirs, Khrushchev stated that Stalin understood the importance of Lend-Lease aid from the United States. Khrushchev wrote about Stalin, "He stated bluntly that if the United States had not helped us, we would not have won the war." That's it for today. Please subscribe to this podcast. Please like this and my other episodes. Reviews greatly help. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, it's easy to do. Scroll down the History and Lies show page, select a rating, hopefully 5 stars, and then tap Write a Review. If you are listening on Spotify or any other podcast app which allows ratings, I would greatly appreciate a 5-star rating. Please tell your friends, relatives, coworkers. Word of mouth is the best way to increase the audience for History and Lies. Check out my website, historyandlies.com, where you will find links to fun items for all history geeks. Thank you for listening. Catch you next episode.